No, not time to get started? No. Oh, come, Steve. Okay, so hopefully you guys found that a good learning experience. Yeah, right? Okay, good. Right, so any event, what we wanted to do today was to finish talking about the Chapter 4 stuff, which is basically just looking at comparisons of populations, ANOVA tests, things like that. And then we'll actually move back a little bit. We'll go take a look at linear regression and the basic concept behind linear regression, which is actually, as engineers, the thing that you guys will probably be using the most. The idea of how do I go and take a set of data, a set of measurements? How do I go and fit some kind of a model to that? How do, ultimately, do I estimate what are the magnitude of these model parameters? How do I use those model parameters to go calculate something I really want? Because usually, the model parameters are not directly what you're interested in. Instead, you're interested in something that's calculated from them. And then, of course, ultimately, you're going to want to get error estimates for all of these different values. But before we start that, I did want to go and finish off talking about what happens if you want to look at many different samples. This is stuff that's covered at the end of chapter 4. And this is something that you're going to be doing a lot of times in biology, where you wind up having a whole bunch of different responses to different types of treatments or to different types of diet or to different types of conditions. And the idea is that you want to try and figure out, are they all from the same population, or is one of them, or more than one of them, different from the others, right? And the problem is that you can do a combinatoric test, okay? So the idea is that I could test, say, sample one, all right? Say might be, sample one might be, you know, a particular drug or might be a particular dosage level, and look at the response of that. I could take sample two, it would be a different drug. Sample three would be the effect of another drug, and so forth. And looking at all these different cohorts, then compare them, all right, one by one in a combinatoric fashion to see if any of them are different from the others. Now, the difficulty with that is that the response is always going to be a random variable. And as you guys know, drug responses can be really random in terms of the response of each of a group of individuals. So there's going to be a fair amount of statistical uncertainty with each one of these samples. And as a result, when you do the t-test to go and compare these two samples to see if the null hypothesis is accepted or rejected at, say, a probability of 95%, well, that means that 1 in 20 times you reject the null hypothesis, even though they really were part of the same distribution, right? So that's the idea. When you're doing these kinds of tests, you want to evaluate the null hypothesis. So the null hypothesis would be that sample A is the same as sample B, and sample B is the same as sample C, and sample C is the same as sample D, and so forth. Well, I got a bunch of these, I'm toast, all right? And the reason why I'm toast is because if I do a combinatoric evaluation, say, supposing I have 8 of these guys, so 8 different groups that I'm trying to test against each other in a combinatoric fashion, and I want to do them all at the 95% confidence level for doing my null hypothesis testing, well, the problem is that I've got to do 8 times 7 divided by 2, or 28 different trials. And by the time you do 28 different comparisons, all at the 2 sigma, or the 95% confidence interval level, well, that means that the probability that you rejected at least one of those null hypotheses is pretty high, even if they really were all part of the same population, right? Because each time you did this, you had a 1 in 20 shot that it was just, you know, you're rejecting the null hypothesis at random. Well, that means there was a 95% probability you got it right, if they were really part of the same population, but you raise 0.95 to the 28th power, And all of a sudden, you've got a better than even chance of rejecting a null hypothesis, even though there really was nothing there, right? And so that's unacceptable. And so the question is, well, all right, how do you do that? And there's another approach to doing that, which is used in biology, not too much in engineering, but it's used in biology, which is called the ANOVA test. And it's actually a cute kind of technique. Basically, what you're doing in an ANOVA test is you're saying, okay, supposing I have a whole group of samples. So I have a set of values, say some X1s, some X2s, some X3s, and so forth. All right? So from each one of these groups, it's possible to calculate a mean, right, easily enough, and to calculate a standard deviation. Okay. So the standard deviation of this particular group is going to be 1 over n minus 1, the sum from I equals 1 to n of xi minus, or excuse me, x, we'll call it x1i minus x1 bar, okay, squared. Adding that up, estimating what the variance is, and then comparing that, adding this up for all of these different values. I can do that for each one of these different groups. Okay? Each one is going to give me now an estimate of the variance for that particular group. Well, supposing they were all really part of the same distribution, I can then compute a variance over the entire set. So in other words, pretend that they're not actually different groups. Pretend that just in a single supergroup, I can compute a mean for that group, and I can compute a variance for that group. Both of them will give you unbiased estimates of the variance in the system. Right? So what the ANOVA test does, which is stands, well, it's an acronym. It stands for Analysis of Variances. Basically, it says, okay, if they were all part of the same population, I should get pretty much the same estimate for the variance if I took the entire group and calculated a variance, or if I took each of the individual groups and averaged the variances I calculate from each one of those. Right? I get pretty much the same value because both, if it's all part of the same distribution, both of them are going to be unbiased estimates of the population variance. But if one of them is different from the others, if one of those groups, say, had a different mean from the others, then maybe it has the same overall variance to it, right? But when I go and combine it with the other ones, because it's a different mean, it shifts the mean of the whole population off by a little bit. And so the variance that you calculate based on assuming that the whole group was one homogeneous population is substantially larger than the variance that you would get from each subpopulation, which you then just average together to get a number. So you see how this game is played? Right? So this now gives you a statistic which enables you to go and say, okay, one of these guys, we don't know which one, right? But one of these samples is different from the others because the magnitude of the variance that you calculate with all of the different values put together is much greater than the value of the variance that you get from averaging each of the individual sample variances together from each individual subgroups. And so this forms what's called the F statistic. And just like the Z statistic and the T statistic, it's got a distribution. It's not a normal distribution, right? The F statistic has a nice distribution that you can go and look up. And it will tell you what is the probability that at least one of these guys, one of these samples, is different from all of the other samples. So that's what ANOVA test is. Have any of you guys wind up using that in biology? You've used that one? What problem did you use that on? Ah, did they ever explain to you why it worked?
It was last year.
All right, so this is college biology. If it was a whole year ago, that means that of course, that's ancient history at this point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's one of the things that always drives professors nuts, right? One of the problems that you guys are going to have is odds are I'm going to be teaching fluid mechanics next fall. The teaching list hasn't come out. So unless you escape and go and take McCready's class, which is a perfectly fine class on biofluid mechanics, unless you escape and take that one, you guys are going to see me again. And I will know exactly what you learned this semester. Yeah, you won't be able to deny all knowledge this time, right? Or at least you can deny it, but you're not going to get away with it. So, right. Excuse me? Yeah, that's fluid mechanics, right? Transport one is fluids. Transport two is heat and mass. Sorry, guys. That's the schedule. Okay, so any event, this is the idea behind calculating the differences between groups. There are all kinds of other variance tests that people use. This was described as a one-sided ANOVA test. It doesn't really tell you anything about which one is bigger, although it's relatively straightforward to figure that out. It doesn't tell you anything about whether there's more than one that's different and so forth. But it does give you at least some information. There's something that you need to go and look at and see. Question?
Yeah, when you say one of the samples is not like yours, do you mean so X1 is different from X2 is different from X3?
Right, so supposing, all right, so example, supposing I'm looking at the drug response for, say, four different drugs, right? So I have four different treatment regimens, and I've got treatment regimen 1, treatment regimen 2, treatment regimen 3, and placebo, okay? And by the way, placebos work, right? Okay, so, you know, that's one of the problems, of course, is the placebos. Well, your body has amazing mechanisms for fixing things, right? I mean, that's why we're alive, is the fact that their body has enormous self-repair mechanisms. Otherwise, you know, it's amazing that things can live, right? But the issue is the placebos, of course, will also, if you tell somebody that they're smart, they'll be smarter, right? If you tell somebody that they got a good night's sleep, they actually will perform better on tests. There was recently a study came out showing that. They put people in a sleep study institute, and they evaluated their sleep patterns and so forth, and they told people bogus information saying that, oh, you had a certain amount of high-quality REM sleep last night or whatever, and then they would give them this battery of tests, and there was a statistically significant difference. The people that they told had a good night's sleep did better on this test, the cognitive test, than people that they told didn't have a good night's sleep, which is kind of cute, right? So if you're coming into an exam, have someone tell you, hey, man, you slept like a log last night. You're in great shape. Probably do better, right? Any event, supposing we have different groups, okay? And the idea is that we're trying to go and figure out, is one of the responses different from the others, all right? Well, usually you want to find one that's better than the others. So if I look at the response, say, the degree to which, or some measure of disease progression for these different populations, if I look at those four different values, I can use the ANOVA test to go and say, okay, are all of those part of the same distribution? In other words, do we satisfy the null hypothesis? Or do we reject the null hypothesis and conclude that one of those populations is different from the others? And the key issue is that you could just look at the mean of each one and say, oh, that this one did better than that one and so forth. But you want to know, is that statistically significant? And the problem is that if you have enough of these guys, enough different samples, and you do combinatoric studies, you're pretty much guaranteed that you're going to say that this one is better than that one to some 95% confidence limit, even though they really weren't. In other words, you'll make a type one error of rejecting the null hypothesis. If you're interested in doing pre-med, they have an increased emphasis on statistics on the MCATs now. And you guys are all under the new MCAT. So go and study chapter 4, okay? Because that will give you the information that you need to try and do better on the MCAT. For engineering, we tend not to use ANOVA as much because, as I said, we're more interested in estimating parameters and trying to determine what the magnitude and uncertainty of parameters are in a system. So it's much more about linear and nonlinear regression and error propagation than it is about variance testing. Okay, well, one last thing before we move on to regression I want you guys to think about is the issue of independence and normality. All right, so all of the formulas we've done so far have pretty much been assuming that our data is normally distributed. And a lot of times the data is not normally distributed simply by nature of the result. If I take a sample of particles, right? So I just scoop out some sand from a bag down in my laboratory and I say, okay, what is the distribution of particle sizes, right? It's not going to be normal distribution. I'm going to have an average size, okay, but I'm going to wind up getting a lot of tails because typically what happens is that when you get a sample, you're going to have an upper threshold. You're not going to see anybody bigger than a certain value, usually because it's gone through a sieve or something else, but you're going to see a lot of fines. You're going to see a lot of tails. So if I'm doing a number density of particle size, I'm going to wind up getting something for a distribution which is going to look like this. If I plot number density, n versus a radius of a particle, I'm going to see a distribution which is going to look like that. So I'm going to have a mean associated with it. I'm going to have a maximum value. Okay, I'll have a median, but I'm not going to have a normal distribution. And so a lot of times you try to figure out, well, how do I go and deal with that? How do I go and recast this problem so that I wind up having something that looks like a normal distribution? One way of doing that is to change the variable. For example, supposing I'm not looking at the number density, supposing I look at a volume fraction. If I look at a volume fraction, what happens is that actually will wind up producing something that's much closer to a normal distribution. And the reason why is because I may have a whole lot of these guys, but they're not going to be very big. Their volume is going to be very small. And so that's going to shift the distribution to a different value. Another thing I could do is I could look at, instead of looking at I could look at different parameters. So if I were plotting what is the mass of each of the particles, or if I'm plotting number density versus mass, I would have something that is extremely skewed, all right? Because in that case, the particles that were very small would wind up having a mass that goes as the radius cubed. So in that case, I would be better off, if I were trying to get something closer to being a normal distribution, I'd be better off plotting number density versus radius, not number density versus volume, okay? So you can sometimes go and transform your distribution from one shape to something that is more closely approximated by a normal distribution by doing a simple variable transform. Figuring out some new variable which will give you something that's much closer to being normally distributed. Another thing, though, to recognize is that nearly always, if the standard deviation of something is very small, then it's going to look a lot like a normal distribution. Okay, so the closer your standard the standard deviation is to being, or is tighter about a mean, you tend to approach a normal distribution. The other thing to remember is the problem is always going to be in the tails, right? As an example, for this particular case, supposing my sample was really a mixture of, say, big particles and little particles. Well, I might have a bimodal distribution. I might have something where I have, say, something that's relatively tight and then a really broad tail because I have a couple of samples mixed together. Right? Doesn't have to be symmetric, so forth. When you do this kind of work, you want to go and take a look at plot, if you can, what your distribution actually looks like. And then think about what the implications of that are for doing calculations, whether your distribution is normal or log normal or some other form. And so all of that will affect the answers, because our answers that we use, where we get using these error propagation formulas, are assuming that that we can approximate any functions we use by truncating after the linear term in a Taylor series expansion, and that our distributions are normally distributed with some standard deviation variance, mean and variance. Okay? All right. So that's going to be a problem. Okay. Well, as I said, that's all I wanted to talk about in terms of looking at these kinds of parametric testing and things like that. But do take a look at that carefully, particularly if you're interested in taking the MCATs, and actually recognizing the difference between Z-statistic and T-statistic is useful even for engineers, because a lot of times you're going to go and try and estimate standard deviations based on limited data, right? Hopefully you have more than two values, right? But a lot of times data is kind of expensive to get, and so you'll estimate a standard deviation based on an inadequate sample size, and just recognize that the standard deviation in that case is not governed by the Z statistic, it's governed by the T statistic. So it's a lot wider in terms of the distribution relating that to confidence intervals. Okay, well, let's talk about linear regression. And much of this stuff I think is probably going to be review for you guys, because I'm sure that you've all done linear regression, right? The first thing to note, though, with linear regression is actually not necessarily fitting a line to data, okay? Linear regression simply means that your model, whatever model you come up with, has to be linear in your modeling parameters. Those are the unknown free wishes that you're using to try and have your nice curve go through your data. So linear regression does not stand for fitting it to a line, although it certainly can be, right? It means that it's linear in the modeling parameters. Okay, so supposing I look at an example, classic example of chemical engineering. Supposing I've got some kind of a membrane. I have some membrane with some area A. And I've got two reservoirs here. I've got some reservoir one and some reservoir two. And I'm trying to go and measure the properties of this a mass transfer process between these two reservoirs. Supposing this guy has some volume V, I've got I'm looking at how does the reservoir I'm going to assume that this concentration over here is going to be some C equilibrium. That's the easy way of doing it. This one is going to have a concentration C at T equals to zero is equal to some C naught. And I'm going to have some mass transfer coefficient through this membrane, where C is going to be the solute is going to be passing across that membrane, diffusing into the other side. And so the concentration in this reservoir, if C naught is greater than C equilibrium, the concentration is going to be going down as a function of time. And I want to go and use this to try and measure what is the mass transfer coefficient associated with this membrane? All right, so how much resistance to transfer am I going to get? Okay, so the differential equation that the thing is going to be governed by in this case is V dc dt equals to a minus A times a mass transfer coefficient times a C minus C equilibrium. We have the initial condition C at T equals to zero is equal to some C naught. And so now the question is, well, all right, what is the what's the solution to this problem? And that's, of course, an easy equation to solve. You guys all know what the answer to this guy is, right? Right? Linear first order ordinary differential equation? Yes? No? Yes. All right. Basically, first order differential equation, first order linear ODEs are the one freebie in the world of differential equations. You can write down the answer. All right. There's a general solution to any first order linear ordinary differential equation, no matter how weird some of the things in there are in terms of functions of time and so forth, you could still solve it. All right. So in any event, for this particular case, you just get an exponential decay. C is going to be equal to some C naught, or excuse me, C equilibrium. That's the long time asymptote, plus some C naught minus C equilibrium times E to the minus now HTA over V. All right, so that's going to be a characteristic decay time associated with diffusion through this membrane from one well-stirred reservoir to another reservoir, which is maintained at some concentration C equilibrium. And so the way you're going to do this in the laboratory, you might be interested in characterizing the mass transfer characteristics of your membrane by measuring the concentration as a function of time and calculating H. So what you would get then is a series of measurements of the concentration, and then you want to go and try and figure out, well, what is H? And the thing is that nearly always in engineering, you're going to be interested in some parameter, and I can't directly do linear regression on this kind of a model, right? Because the model is not linear in the unknowns. The unknowns that I might have here might be, say, some the unknown parameters might be, say, in this case, I probably would use the amplitude of C naught minus C equilibrium as an unknown parameter. But the thing is, it's not going to be linear in this guy. And so what I have to do is I have to take my model and I have to massage it so that my new model is linear in the unknown modeling parameters. And that's going to produce some new, generally, it's going to produce some new modeling parameter that might be different from what our original modeling parameter was. Now, in this particular case, for these kinds of exponential decay problems, what you're going to do is you're saying, okay, let me go and massage this a little bit. So C minus C equilibrium equals to C naught minus C equilibrium times E to the minus HTA over V. All right. And so now if I take the logarithm of both sides, I get that the log of C minus C equilibrium is going to be equal to the log of C naught minus C equilibrium minus HA over V times time. And so now, actually, I get a problem where I can literally fit this to a line. All right. Remember, it didn't have to be a line. All right. It just had to be linear in whatever my unknowns are. But I could set the problem up where now my measurement, if you like, instead of it being the concentration, instead what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, my measurement will be the log of C minus C equilibrium. Now there's a concentration difference, and take the natural log of that. That will be my measurement. and then my model is going to be x1 minus or plus x2 times time. So I literally will fit this to a line. So I get then the following. Let's look at this thing. Well, we'll look at it the following way. Let's let y be equal to the log of c minus c equilibrium. We'll let a be equal to h over v, and we'll let b be equal to the log of c naught minus c equilibrium. And then I have as my equation is just simply going to be y equals to, y equals to b plus a t, or actually minus a t. So that would be a simple model for describing the describing the behavior. Okay. So if we do that, now the question is, well, I've recast this in terms of a model that's now linear in my modeling parameters. How do I determine whether or not things match? Okay. And so the way I do that, actually, let me make that minus sign, so now I have a plus. There we are. Okay. So if I look at this thing, I wind up getting, I'm going to use linear regression, which requires me to regress or to determine the deviation between my data points, which in this case are these measured y's, and my model values. And the way I'm going to go and determine whether I've got the correct values is I'm going to try to minimize the sum of squares of the deviation. Effectively, what I can do is I can define a residual, which is going to be yi minus b plus ati. This is going to have a different value for each one of my data points. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take that difference, I'm going to square it, and I'm going to add it up. And I'm going to try to minimize then the 2 norm of this residual. So the way you do that to find a minimum of a function is to take the derivative and set it equal to 0. For a line, it's pretty straightforward to demonstrate how you do that. And that is that if I call this quantity, let's say sum, which is the square of the 2 norm of the residual, if I say I want to find values of a and b such that this guy is a minimum, then I'm going to say that partial of the sum, partial a equals to 0, and partial of the sum, partial b equals to 0. If my line goes exactly through my data points, then the sum would be identically 0, and that would be the minimum possible value that my sum could take on, because it has to be positive. All the contributions are going to be positive. Okay, well, in this particular case, fitting a line to data is actually pretty straightforward. If I take the derivative of the sum with respect to A, I wind up getting, this is going to be, well, what? It's the sum from I equals 1 to N of, now, let's see, it's going to be minus... it's going to be derivative with respect to A, so I'm going to get minus 2 times yi minus a ti plus b plus b times ti. Okay? Because I get the 2 from the square, all right, I get the ti because I've got this particular, or the minus ti, from the derivative of this guy with respect to A. Yeah?
Is that sum there the same thing, more or less, the r squared value?
It is exactly the r squared value, right? It is the square of the residual. Right? It's the square of the 2 norm of the residual. Okay, well, I can go and recast this, all right? And if I do that, I wind up getting this is equal to the sum from I equals 1 to n of minus 2 Y-I-T-I plus 2A times the sum from I equals 1 to N of T-I squared plus 2B sum I equals 1 to N of T-I equals to 0. And so this is going to be one of our equations for my two unknowns. And it's actually interesting to look at it. This is why you were able to do it using old calculators. Because remember, old calculators only had a certain number of memories associated with it, very limited number of memories, and yet you could still fit lines to data. Right? You take a look at the really old calculators, right? When they finally got fancy enough to do linear regression, which was pretty rapidly, you could fit lines to data. And the way you do that is instead of keeping track of all of the individual values, you could keep track of the sum of, for each of my data points of yi and ti, the sum of ti squared and the sum of ti. And that would be all you would need for that particular equation, to satisfy that particular equation, is to keep track of those values. Well, that's half the information you need. The other half the information you need is setting the derivative of B with respect to 0. And so in that case, you would have partial sum partial B equals to the sum from I equals 1 to N of minus 2, again, yi minus a ti plus b. That one is easier. There's no ti in there. And so therefore, that is going to be equal to the sum from I equals 1 to n of minus 2 yi plus 2a times the sum from I equals 1 to n of ti plus 2n times b, all that equals to 0 as well. So I've got two equations, two unknowns, and the answer is simply going to be the following. I have that a t squared bar plus b t bar equals to y t bar, where the bar, if you like, x bar is just the mean, 1 over n sum I equals 1 to n of some xi. So that's the first equation. The second equation is a t bar plus b equals to y bar. So I just have to calculate these quantities from my data. Right, that one actually I need in both expressions. And I'm good. I can go and calculate a and b. And in fact, you wind up getting that a is equal to y t bar minus y bar t bar divided by t squared bar minus t bar squared. And you get that b equals to y bar minus a t bar. Just rearranging the other equation. So I get a first and then I calculate b. Okay, so that is linear regression. So it's fitting, you fit the data to go and get the value you're interested in, but that's not a terribly efficient way of doing it. It works great if you've got a calculator that's only got about 5 memories associated with it, because as I said, all you have to do is keep track of the sum of y's, the sum of t's, the sum of yt's, the sum of the t squareds, and n. So you have to have 5 memories associated with that. And if you do have 5 memories in your calculator, then no matter how many data points you've got, you can fit a line to it. Okay? But you guys have a computer that have a few more than 5 memories, and so there's actually a far better way of doing it, and one which is generalizable to any problem which is linear in the unknown parameters. And that's doing a matrix representation for linear algebra. So what we're dealing with here we're fitting line to the data, you're fitting a problem where I have a sequence of values of the following form. I have some y1 equals to a, excuse me, some a times t1 plus b. This is what I'd like it to be, right? I have some y2 equals to a t2 plus b, y3 equals to a t3 plus b, and so forth, all right? So you have a sequence of equations you're trying to satisfy. If your line goes exactly through the data points, all of those will be equal signs, right? In practice, though, what you're trying to do is you're trying to minimize the two norm of the residual. I could define this guy here as a vector, so that would be a vector y1, yn. And I'm going to say that's approximately equal to the product of a matrix, T1 up through Tn, and then once associated with the constant term, times now a column vector of my unknowns, A and B. So this thing is very much of the same form as Ax equals to B, right? Which, since it's an overdetermined problem, it's not squared. In this case, I've got fewer unknowns than I have equations I'm trying to satisfy. I can't solve it via LU decomposition. Instead, I would solve it using QR or singular value decomposition. Okay. In other words, I would solve it in a least squared sense. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, let's let this guy, this vector, be x1, x2. That's a vector of unknown quantities. I will let this matrix here, we'll call this matrix some matrix A. And this side over here, we'll call this a vector B, right? This is a vector of measurements. Excuse me? Yeah, I'm going to get all confused, right? Okay, well, all right, we'll call this a vector Y. All right, Y. So this thing is of the form y is approximately equal to a x. So it's a system of linear equations where this matrix here is a matrix of modeling functions. The vector x is the vector of modeling parameters. That's the unknowns. And this side is the vector of measurements that we're making. And so we can define a residual R as being equal to Y minus AX, which is the distance that each one of these data points is missed by our line. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to go and minimize over all X the two norm of R, which is equal to the minimum overall x of r transpose r. In either case, the minimum value, this would be the two norm squared, would be r transpose r, right? Because the norm would be the square root of the of r transpose r. So that's the regression problem. Yeah?
What does that say after the two norm equal signs? What's the minimum?
Minimum over all x. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to figure out for what value of x. The regression problem is figuring out what values of x cause us to have the minimum two norm for the residual. And that's the linear regression problem. Note that that's not the only way of doing it, right? You could define any objective function. So for example, you could say your objective function here would be maybe supposing you want to do the Manhattan norm, right? Supposing we decided that really it's more might be more appropriate to go and look at minimizing the sum of the absolute value of the residuals, which is fine, but that's not linear regression, right? And the reason why is because if you have that as your objective function, you can't solve it, right? You have to do the whole problem in a nonlinear fashion. It turns out that for this particular case, for any system which is linear in my modeling parameters, I can wind up getting a direct solution to the problem, solving it in a least squared sense. And in fact, you know how to do that via singular value decomposition or QR factorization or whatever. Okay? Yeah?
When someone accepts to minimize the least squared error by using source formula, what does accept
Excel would be using would be doing exactly this. It would be doing minimizing the two norm, and it would directly calculate it. Internally, what it's doing, darned if I know. But ultimately, it would wind up doing some form of regression. There are a couple of different approaches that you can do. You can do this using QR. As we'll also demonstrate, though, you can actually use or develop what are called the normal equations for Gaussian elimination, which have certain advantages and certain disadvantages. Yeah?
T
is usually, say, you know, time. In this case, T would be time. And Y would usually be your measured values. Except what happens is that actually when you've massaged your model, okay, in order to make it linear, a lot of times you've changed things. For example, in this particular problem, you have to go to linearize your model. You have to go and measure your equilibrium concentration, okay? And you have to measure C naught. So you're trying to go and calculate the variation of the log of C minus C equilibrium over time. Well, the problem is that you wind up actually sometimes your modeling functions may wind up getting some, in this case it's not too bad, but you may wind up getting some of your data measurements in your modeling functions too. You can distort the dependence of your regression parameters on your data through the linearization process. And we'll actually see some examples of where that does bad things. In this particular case, the distortion is that you, in general, you're going to have some error associated with all of your concentration measurements, right? Well, the problem is, for this particular case, your C equilibrium is a measured concentration too. But you have to, in linear regression, you have to use that in every single one of your new data points, right? Well, so what does that tell you about the matrix of covariance of B, or of Y, your measured values? Are they all going to be independent? No, they can't be independent. They can't be independent because we're going to be using C naught, or C equilibrium rather, in every last one of those guys, right? And so as a result, the linearization process will sometimes distort things. Now it still works, all right? You still generally do it this way, but what it tends to do is to place undue weight on certain parameters. So you have to be very careful in doing your error calculations. Yeah.
Could you, in this case, instead of using like C naught as your, or C equilibrium or that, could you choose a midway concentration and then like fit 2 seconds of the line? Therefore, you wouldn't like weight it all on the front.
No. If you've got a problem with C equilibrium, which is usually the issue, by the way, in fact, you'll do this experiment. It's usually done in senior. Well, no, actually, I think they're doing it in junior lab now. So you'll be doing it next year. But when you do when you're looking at a problem where it's going to equilibrium, you're doing the linearization process to try to go and get something. You can use linear regression. The thing really depends on getting C equilibrium right, because the darn thing is involved in every single data point. All right, so. The weight that you're placing on that value is huge. So in that case, unless you know that guy really, really, really accurately, one way around that is to just give up and say, okay, I'm going to use nonlinear regression. So what I'll do is I'll formulate exactly the same kind of problem, but instead of doing this transform problem, I will instead go and take the original measurements, original model, and I'll just say, okay, it's a nonlinear model in my unknown parameters. No biggie, I got a good computer. So I'll calculate a residual based on that, and then I will go and calculate the two norm of that residual. And then now, as I don't have linear regression, I can't directly calculate the parameters anymore. Instead, what I will do is I'll say, okay, I will do a function minimization process by doing something that Professor Shaw will show you about later on this semester and throw it in under some kind of a global minimization routine.
To still use a linear regression and not emphasize the weight on your equilibrium?
Yes. Well, no. You can't get rid of the equilibrium issue. You can use what's called weighted linear regression, which is something else that we'll be looking at in the next few lectures. What also happens when you do this kind of process is that you'll find that you put far more weight on data points which are very close to equilibrium. Okay, and so what happens is that, you know, supposing you're measuring it out to very long time, so that the thing's nearly completely decayed, right? And so now what happens is that the uncertainty in those last values becomes very large, because now it's the difference between C minus C equilibrium, no problem, that is going to have about the same uncertainty as ever, but I'm taking the logarithm of it. And as that guy goes to zero, the logarithm blows up. And so you're going to have you have to use a nonlinear weighting between the two. Are any of you guys familiar with monad kinetics? Growth kinetics? It's used in biology all the time, looking at growing yeast. In fact, it's one of the senior lab experiments you guys will be doing. Basically, what you're doing is you're calculating the growth of yeast as a function of time. And after you pass a lag phase, which basically means that's the time that these bugs or the yeast cells, which I guess is what, a fungus, whatever, any event, the yeast cells are getting used to their new environment. After a lag phase, you go into an exponential growth phase where they multiply. And then eventually, you wind up getting a deceleration phase, and then it stops. The deceleration phase is either due to accumulation of poisons, as in that's why your wine has a certain concentration of alcohol associated with it, or alternatively, it's due to exhausting all of the sugar, as is going to be the case in the senior lab experiment. When you're trying to fit this kind of a process, the monad kinetics model that you're using to do this, it's a nonlinear model. But people have developed ways of going and doing something called a Lineweaver-Burk plot, which is a massaging of the model, much the same as this is. It's a different procedure, this is a different equation, but it's the same basic sort of idea. You're recasting it so that the parameters, your new parameters you're in, are obtained by fitting a line and getting a slope and an intercept to your new line. Well, the problem with that is that it does not place weight on all of your measurements evenly anymore. It distorts the weight placed on individual measurements. And so as a result, you are not getting necessarily the best possible model. Again, there are two ways of dealing with that. One way is using a weighted linear regression, and we'll see how that works. Another way of doing is saying, okay, let me go back to the original raw data, use the nonlinear model, and do a nonlinear regression process on that. And so in senior lab, actually, you get to do it all three ways. Actually, I don't think that Professor Sadawi has you doing the weighted linear regression. I'll have to try and suggest that for you guys, since you'll be experts at that. Okay, so any event, what we're trying to do is we're trying to minimize the two norm of R transpose R. So we're picking some value of X such that R transpose R is as small as possible. We can write out what R transpose R is. Okay, so R transpose R. R is a column vector, so R transpose R is a scalar value. That is going to be equal to Let's see, in this case, it's a measured values y minus a x transpose y minus a x. Because a x was your model and y were your measurements, and so it's the difference between the two that is the residual. So I can actually multiply that out if I like. If I do that, I get that this is going to be equal to y transpose y minus y transpose a x minus x transpose a transpose y plus x transpose a transpose a x. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to go take the derivative of this guy with respect to x1 and x2, or actually however many modeling functions I have, modeling parameters I have, and then set it equal to 0. And so that's equivalent to taking what is the gradient with respect to x of r transpose r, and setting that equal to 0. Right? So if I do that, I wind up getting a set of, in this case, two equations for my two unknowns, x1 and x2. And if you calculate what that gradient is, it turns out that grad with respect to x of r transpose r is going to be equal to minus 2 a transpose y plus 2 a transpose a x. And I'm setting that equal to 0. And so now what I get is a square problem, which is a transpose a x equals to a transpose y. And this problem you can solve via LU factorization if you want to. There are any number of different ways of looking at that. We can actually go and invert this. So we can say that x is equal to a transpose a inverse times a transpose times our vector y. So this is now a matrix. I can just call this matrix AK. That's a matrix now which only involves the modeling functions evaluated at certain times. And what it tells you is that the modeling parameters I'm trying to figure out are just linear combinations of my measurements. Okay? Just linear combination of the measurements. In this case, K would be two rows and N columns associated with it, associated with the N different measurements. But what it says is that each one of those parameters is just going to be some linear combination of my N measurements. And that is a very powerful statement in terms of saying, how do my values that I'm trying to get depend on my measurements? And what you'll find is that even, you know, for a case where you're fitting things linearly, they don't depend uniformly on the different measurements. Okay? Different values are going to depend very differently on the individual measurements. Well, let's take a look at the example for today, and hopefully that will make things a little bit clearer. So we'll run example 13 today, and that's linked into today's notes. So let's go and run this. And basically, what we're doing is we're doing exactly this problem. We have a set of concentrations and times. And so I just take some values that are, you know, exponential decay with some noise associated with it. And we're not waiting too long, so we're not going to bias stuff too much. Any event, if we plot this up, we wind up getting now a series of concentrations as a function of time. The equilibrium value that we have generated this thing for, actually, we're getting fairly close to it. The equilibrium value is taken to be 1 at long time. So we'll assume that we know that very, very accurately. And that actually would cause cause some issues. So that's concentration as a function of time, and these are the different measurements that we're making. Okay, so we want to go and use regression. And so we're going to have to go and recast the data so that it's now linear in the modeling parameters. And so we wind up picking our functions. Our data now is going to be log of C minus C equilibrium. And our unknown parameters are going to be the data is log of C minus C equilibrium. The parameters are going to be log of the initial concentration difference and then this quantity. And again, what I'd be interested in calculating ultimately would be H. That would be the thing that you might report in your paper. What is the mass transfer coefficient for the system? Okay, so we can solve this thing directly, and we can use the formula that we had before. And this is the formula that we worked out to begin with, and we get these two values for x2 and for x1. So it's exactly what we dealt with. This is going to be yt. This is going to be the sum of y, sum of t over n, right? That's going to be the sum of t squared, and that's going to be t bar squared. Okay, so if we do that, we have these values, and we can go and look at my figure, and there we go. All right, so we wind up getting this curve going through the data by fitting this thing. Now, one of the things that you'll note here, and this is something to pay a little bit of attention to, is that the curve, you know, kind of looks kind of jagged, right? But the model really is continuous, all right? So when you're plotting up the model, you generally want to use more data points, pseudo data points, or times of evaluation of your model than the data points that you're actually using for measurements, the times you're using for measurements. And that enables you to get a smooth curve. And so one way of doing that is to construct a new vector, which goes from the minimum value of my measurement times to the maximum value, but it has a lot more values in it. And then I just simply plot that up too. And so that's going to give us our black curve. And so that's going to give you a lot cleaner result. I mean, ultimately, you'll see that at these particular times associated with where the evaluation is done, obviously they have to be the same because it's the same model. But it illustrates the continuous nature of your model. So it's a much cleaner way of doing it. Okay, there are more ways of doing it. One way of doing it is to go and define the matrix of modeling functions, which is misspelled, as a matrix A, all right? And so my matrix A then is going to be an array of ones, and that's associated with the constant, and an array of times, which is associated with the different times at which I'm evaluating it, because I'm trying to fit it to a straight line in terms of the way the regression itself is actually being done. The right-hand side is our measured data points, and in this case, it's going to be the log of C minus C equilibrium. And you'll note this guy, right, that gets pretty big, right? That value starts becoming quite large, and that's because we're very close to the equilibrium concentration. So in general, this value would be much more sensitive to error than the other values, and all of these values would not be independent because all of them would actually be involving the measured equilibrium concentration, which presumably would have some error associated with it. In any event, we can solve this via the normal equations, A transpose AX equals to A transpose B. And so if we do that, we wind up getting, well, exactly the same values. So here we've done it using the backslash command for A transpose A equals to A transpose backslash A transpose B. And that would actually do it using Gaussian elimination because A transpose A is a square matrix. All right? And if unless I've got an underdetermined linear regression problem. In other words, more parameters than I have data points, all right, which is generally a bad idea, that matrix would be a full rank and usually is well conditioned. But in any event, you wind up getting the backslash command would do it using PLU decomposition for this process. You can also just directly use the backslash command, which in this case, because it's an overdetermined problem, means that it's solving it via QR, and it is actually solving the regression problem in a least squares sense. All right, that's the other process this thing does. And of course, each one of these guys gives you the same value. The last way of looking at it is to actually go and calculate that matrix K. And this is very instructive. Because if you look at the matrix K, remember what this guy is. This is the weighting of each one of the different data points. So how much do each data point, how much of a weight does each data point place on your final result? So remember that the first row of these corresponds to my, the first guy corresponds to the constant value, the ones. The second one corresponds to the times, which is the decay rate. It turns out that the decay rate is very heavily weighted by, say, for example, the last value has the largest weight for this decay constant that I'm interested in calculating, and that actually is the value that you know least well. Because remember, that depends on the log of the difference between that last concentration and the equilibrium concentration, and because it's close to the equilibrium concentration, it's going to give you the largest source of error. So when you calculate the uncertainty in the fitted values, which you want to do, and we'll show how you do that in a bit, in fact, it's very easy to do that. You know that X is just a linear combination of your measured values, and you know how that error propagation formula works, what the matrix of covariance of your fitted values are in terms of the matrix of covariance of B. But the interesting thing to note is that the weight that is placed on each of those measured values is not going to be uniform. And so if the uncertainty in each one of these values is not uniform, it may give rise to a distortion in the uncertainty in your calculated values. Right? Okay. So for this week, this week's project, I haven't quite finished typing the thing up yet. In fact, I noticed after I uploaded it, I managed to forget to put in the equation, so I'm going to have to go fix that. But what I'm going to be doing for this week's project is the following. Let's see. We'll go to this week's project. Actually, that's not there yet. It will be shortly. We'll go to that week's project, and we'll go to this, and we'll change it to that. No. There we are. Right. So the equation's missing. Okay. So what I want you guys to do is the following. Cherry blossoms are in bloom in California. Is that depressing or what? Right. Any event, yeah, it's around Chinese New Year and all kinds of good stuff. But this is a fun time of year in San Francisco, a little bit less so around here. Any event, what I want you to do is I want you to go and analyze temperature data again. So we'll take a look at the temperature data and use the Indianapolis stuff. I got to change some parameters. Basically, what I want you to do is, we know that our temperature is seasonal, right? So it goes up in the summer and down in the winter. So a reasonable model to go and use is to assume that the temperature distribution is a periodic function of time, a sine wave. But the minimum temperature does not occur on January 1st or December 21st, which might make more sense, because that is the day, the shortest day of the year, the day when you have the minimum solar radiation. Instead, what happens is that it's shifted off from that, which is sort of a measure of the amount of heat capacity associated with the biosphere, mostly the atmosphere, but also the land and so forth. In other words, it takes some time. There's a lag between the time where you have the minimum amount of heating from the sun in the northern hemisphere and when it actually gets coldest. So that's what we're going to try and look at this time, to see if we can take that 3 years of data and to go and calculate what we think the minimum, the day associated with the minimum temperature should be. All right? And in any event, what we're going to do is we're going to fit it to a sine wave. I'll have the correct equation on here by the time I get the rest of it uploaded. I want you to first take this problem, which will be the differential equations, of course, very straightforward. The equation is going to be the low temperature, TL, is equal to some TL bar, right, some average value, plus some amplitude times, say, a cosine, 2 pi T star, or T, minus phi. So that would be the model that you would want to fit the problem to. You anticipate what this model is going to produce. You're interested in this guy, and you're interested in the amplitude, and you're interested in the average low temperature. Okay? So you want to calculate those guys. You've got three sets of data for three different years. All right? You want to go and compute what is the value that you would get for these parameters for each one of those 3 years. So it gives you three realizations of this particular value. But that problem, you can't directly use linear regression on that problem. First, you have to go and take the model and you have to recast it into a model which is linear in your modeling parameters. Any bets on how to do that? No, you don't want to do the inverse that way. Because you don't know what TL is. You don't know what TL bar is. So here you have as unknown parameters, this guy, this guy, this guy. Right? You're measuring these guys. You know what the times are. From those data points, you assume that average low for a particular month was at the midpoint of the month. That's a reasonable estimate. Right? So how do I go and recast this model so that it is linear in the modeling parameters? So it's not. I got this cosine function in there. How do I do that? Not going to want to do a Taylor series, right? What about you guys remember your trigonometric relationships?
Yes?
All right, so what do I do with the trigonometric? What trigonometric relationship is particularly appropriate to this problem? Excuse me? What did you say? Double angle? Well, it's not double angle, but yeah, sum and difference, right? And so what you're doing there is you're going to want to break this thing up, okay, so that you wind up getting something which is just cosine 2t times a cosine 2 pi phi. And then you're going to get another modeling function which is going to be the same but sine 2t sine 2 pi phi. So you'll have to work your way through it, all right? And so now you're going to get new modeling parameters that involve A and phi, okay? And then you're going to calculate from those new modeling parameters when is the what time during the year is the temperature the lowest, all right? And so that gives you now, from each one of these 3 years, it gives you three realizations of these values. Okay, so, you know, from three data points, you can calculate a mean, and you can calculate a standard deviation, and you can calculate the error, an unbiased estimate of the standard deviation of the mean, okay? And then I want you to go and calculate what the 90% confidence interval of the averages are that you got in three, right? And how large is your data set? What statistics are you going to need to use? Yeah. So one of the things I want you guys to do is type in help t-test, all right? Or doc t-test if you really want to get the detailed information. Because it's not going to be normally distributed. You're going to have your sample size isn't large enough for that to be the case. And then finally, I want you to go compare these to exact values that you can find on the web. In Telecast, if you just plug in Indianapolis and look at historical averages, will tell you exactly what your average low temperatures are. And I want you to go think about this, why your values might disagree from those values, okay? In other words, what approximations and assumptions are you making in doing your problem and setting it up this way that may not be valid? So as I said, I'll have the correct version with the actual equation and with the correct fonts in there, and I'll have that put up probably by the time Thermo is over. Okay? Good enough.
What?